Everybody, please open up the, if you have a Bible, the the book of Numbers, and that will be chapter 21. I'd like to go through what I consider to be one of the most fascinating stories in the entire Torah, and it's interesting in its own right, and if you read it superficially, it presents us with something which would appear to be a very serious dilemma, and I'd like to try and resolve that dilemma tonight. So let's turn to chapter 21, the book of Numbers, verse 4. And we'll read the story together, and then I'll try and set up the problems. And then we'll go into the analysis. This takes place at the end of the wandering in the wilderness. You know, the Jews wandered in the wilderness for 40 years. And towards the end of that time, God commanded them to move their camps, but they had to move backwards because they didn't receive permission to travel through the land of Edom. So we're going to read from verse 4. It says that they traveled from the mountain called Hor by the way of the Yamsuf, by the way of the sea, the Red Sea, I suppose, to surround the land of Edom. Then it says that the soul of the people became weary on the road. They became tired, and they became disgruntled. And the people spoke about God and Moses and said, "Why did you take us out of Egypt to die in this wilderness? For there is no bread and there is no water, and our souls are weary with this light bread." That was a reference to the manna. As you know, God provided them with manna in the wilderness. And here they were complaining about, they're weary about the difficulty of the travels, but they also single out specifically their discontent with the manna. It's important to know the Hebrew word over here, because Rashi draws an inference from the Hebrew word. I'll get back to that in a minute. Then it says that God sent against the nation the fiery serpents. And what does it mean by fiery serpents? So Rashi explains, serpents which cause a person to be killed by the poison. So they're poisonous snakes. And they bit the people. And a large segment of the people died, were killed by these poisonous snakes. Then the people came to Moses, and they said, "We have sinned, for we spoke against God and against you. Pray for us, pray to God for us, that he may remove the snakes from us." So Moshe accepted their repentance, and he didn't bear a grudge. They had spoken against Moses as well, and Moses was forgiving. And it says that Moses prayed to the people for the prayed to God for the sake of the people. Now, here comes the part that I think is very fascinating. And God said to Moses, "Make for you a serpent and place it on a pole." In other words, he was supposed to sculpt, to fashion out a the image of a serpent. Rashi says that he made it out of copper, and to place it on a pole. And it'll be whoever is bitten, and he will look at it, and he will live. And Moses made the image of the serpent, and he placed it on a pole. And it was, if a snake would bite a person, then he would stare at the sculpted snake, and he would live. So I think the questions are pretty obvious. I'd like to go through all the questions first. Of course, the last issue, the issue of the sculpted snake, is the one which grabs our attention the most. But let's go through it step by step. The questions I'd like to address is, first of all, what exactly was the sin of the people? We know specifically what they did, that they complained. They complained against God and against Moses. But we'd like to know, that was the overt manifestation. What was the underlying defect that was causing them to act in such a way? And I would also like to understand the significance of the punishment, crime and punishment. Now, it's a basic principle of the Torah, God metes out punishment for our sins. As a matter of fact, that's something which is really good, because it's an expression of God's compassion for us that God actually punishes us. Because if God did not punish us, then we'd continue on our evil path and we'd go to destruction. So the punishment gives us an opportunity to return to God. But the punishment always has to be in line with the crime. It has to address itself to the specific problem, the behavior beneath the crime. So here, what's the punishment? The punishment is snakes. God sends snakes against them. So the question arises, is that just an arbitrary thing? In other words, it could have been any type of a calamity? Or is there a specific meaning to the choice, to the particular choice of a snake? We'd have to assume that there is. And this is borne out by Rashi, as we'll soon see in a minute. But more than that, I want to explain why the choice of a snake. But it's also of significance because the text points out not just a snake per se, but a poisonous snake. So I think that we should try and explain the reason for the death came about through the poison of a snake. I think that also has a certain significance over here. Okay. Beyond that, up to the last part, the story basically seems to me make sense. It fits into the general pattern. This is not the first time that the Jews have rebelled in the wilderness. They've rebelled many times because of the travails, because of weariness, because of the fear that they wouldn't have food, and so on and so forth. And after they are punished, so they turn to Moses. They turn to Moses and they ask Moses to pray. So Moses prays for them. Now, what would we expect at this point? At this point, we would expect that if God found the prayer worthy, then they should have been forgiven. Or if not, then they should have been destroyed. But all of a sudden, we're confronted with something which seems fantastic. It seems, what is the purpose of this image of a snake? It would seem that a person would read this story without the benefit of any interpretation. It seems that the Jews believed in some type of a voodoo. It seems like voodoo, like magic, as though this snake was endowed with magical properties. Where do we find such a concept? It seems that this goes against, it violates every one of the concepts that we're familiar with. We don't believe in any type of magical powers and the charms and so on and so forth. And yet here we see that God ordered Moses to construct the snake, and simply by looking at the snake, they were cured. So that's the main problem that I'd like to address myself to. But I'd like to go through the other steps first, because I think it's only possible to elucidate this. What is the significance of this snake that Moses had constructed, and how exactly did it effectuate this type of a cure? Those are my questions, and I'll pause for a second if anybody has any other questions they'd like to add, or any comments at this point, before I try and elucidate my answers. If not, I'll just continue.
Well, now we got one.
Okay.
All right.
Go ahead.
All right. Why did the people ask Moses to pray? Why did they not pray for themselves?
That's a very good question. That's a very good question.
Okay.
I would say that a person, I suppose, has to be. The truth of the matter is that the rabbis say that the best prayer is the prayer that comes from the one who's smitten himself. But I would say in this situation, perhaps they were too overwhelmed. And the problem is that sin takes a person away from God. They've been distanced from God. And they may have felt that this was a case where they weren't in a situation where they could address God properly. So let's just see. Let's see if I can improve on that as we go along.
Okay, hold on.
Yeah.
Therefore, they need a mediator.
So therefore, they would need a mediator to pray for them. Now, you know where this is going.
Yeah, I know where you're going.
Okay.
I know exactly where you're going. Well, Judaism does not believe You see, Judaism does not believe that that a person needs a mediator to pray for him. Each person has the right and the obligation to pray for himself. The only thing is, though, that is, there's nothing wrong with the idea of having somebody pray for you. In fact, it could be a beneficial thing. The truth is, it doesn't mean there's nothing in here that states that they didn't pray for themselves. They could have prayed for themselves, and yet it was not being effective, and therefore they turned to Moses. Now, the reason why the prayer of one person can work for another person is because the way that it operates is that in order for a person to be answered, for his prayers to be answered, he has to be on a certain level of closeness to God to warrant God's intervention. Not every prayer will bring about the result that a person wants. It depends. The real purpose of praying is to put ourselves in a certain state, to bring ourselves into a certain relationship with God. And by recognizing that God is the source of everything that exists, and that insofar as we have problems, we should turn to God. That's the real benefit. There's no guarantee that the particular that you're asking for is going to be given to you. Nevertheless, a prayer is important for your own perfection. Now, if a person does warrant it, if he raises himself to a high enough level in terms of his appreciation of the good, then he may merit God's intervention. That is the sense in which a prayer can work. Now, therefore, if an individual who is on a very, very high level, if he prays for something, and that particular thing, let's say he prays for somebody else to get well, that becomes part of his needs, so therefore God may cure that person, not in the merit of the person himself, but in the merit of the individual who's praying to God, who does merit God's intervention. So therefore there's a benefit. In other words, like this, let me make it very clear. We do not believe that you require an intermediary to propitiate God. We do not believe in that. A person has the right and the obligation to address God. However, we also believe, and it's part of our custom. In fact, when I just got a phone call right before this class, an individual whose wife is having a serious operation, and they asked us to say prayers at the yeshiva, and he'll be praying as well. But the truth of the matter is that it could be that as a result of our prayers, that we may merit that this person should have a recovery, because it's important to us. It's important to us that this person should be recovered, and it could very well be, it's possible, that we're on the level where God is willing to answer our prayers. That's why there's nothing wrong with having one individual pray for another one. And of course, now Moses is on the highest possible level. And we do see that in the case of the golden calf, that it was the intervention of Moses.
Rabbi?
Yeah, I'm sorry.
I want to jump in right there for a moment.
I'm sorry, what?
I want to ask you a question here, or jump in for a moment. You know, that's kind of East Tennessee slang. I don't know if y'all do that in Rock Rockaway or not. Okay. Now, here's the problem I've got. I understand the logic behind what you're saying.
Yeah.
But the problem I have, if the people are murmuring against God and against Moses, as the text says, then God sends the servants. Why would they ask Moses to intervene for them if they're griping about the conditions anyway? And that's along that same line. You know, you brought us out here, and now, God, you're not taking care of us. You're giving us this light bread to eat, and we like the onions and the garlics and the vegetables of Egypt. And then they, in turn, turn around and say, well, Moshe, pray to God for us so we get the serpents out of the way.
Yeah.
So how could the people...
That's a very good question, too. That's a slightly different question. And the thing is that it's true that they were in a rebellious mood, but once they were smitten, once they were in a state of desperation, you know, that brought them back to their senses. Obviously, when they committed the sin, they were not acting in a rational way. They were allowing their emotions to get the better of them. And that's what happens. Very, very often, people will complain about a leader. And we'll soon find out if I can elucidate what's going on over here. Even a leader that's been very good to them. That's the irony, that Moses was their greatest benefactor. How could they be rebelling against Moses? That's a very powerful question. But nevertheless, we see that once people They've gotten out of one situation of Egypt. Now they're confronted with other problems, so they begin to gripe, they begin to complain. And it could happen any time. It could happen in Israel that they could start complaining about the leaders. Leaders that were great heroes 5 years ago, today they don't like the situation, so they start complaining, and they can impute all kinds of evil things to them. But then if they're attacked by an enemy and they're in a calamity, they have no choice. Suddenly they're going to go back to these leaders. Now that's exactly what happened over here. God put them in a situation. In reality, the situation was not that terrible. They were distorting the situation. The situation they were in was not that bad, obviously. And the question is, why? What caused them to have such a distorted attitude that they would view it as being so terrible? That's what I'd like to elucidate. But given that that's the case, once they were confronted by a real calamity, by a plague, by a destruction, who were they going to turn to? Then they began to think about it, that they're crazy. Well, one second, let's go back to Moses. He's the man that saved us in every situation. Now, why didn't they pray directly to God? It could be because of these emotions that had been brought out. They realized that they were in a totally distorted state. You can't just get up and approach God. Prayer requires preparation. You know that there's many, many laws that pertain to prayer. A person cannot pray to God when he's in a for example, the law states, I don't know if it applies today because situations were different in the times of the Talmud. If a person went on a journey, when he came back from a journey, he had to wait 3 days before he was permitted to pray. Why? Because it was such a, emotionally a frightening situation to travel in those days, to go out on the road and so on and so forth. So a person is not permitted to approach God when he's in that type of a state of trauma. So I would say, having thought the matter through, that that's the best explanation as to why they themselves did not pray. They were caught up in the grip of a trauma. And you can't just pour out any thought that comes into your mind. That's idolatry. To pray properly to God, you have to be able to arrange your thoughts in a very careful way. As the Talmud says, the early sages of the Talmud would take 1 hour of time before they'd praise in order to clear their mind from all types of thoughts and all types of worries and anxieties. So the truth of the matter is that the fact that they were smitten and they were suffering would be the reason why they would not be permitted to engage in prayer. And they realized that they needed somebody with a very clear head. I would say that the truth of the matter is, now that I've thought about it, I would say that's praiseworthy of them. To refrain from prayer, just as it's very significant to engage in prayer at the proper time, to refrain from prayer at the improper time is a recognition of the significance of what prayer is all about, and it's a negation of the idolatrous notion of prayer, where a person is just pouring out his emotions to any being that he's projected in his mind. Our concept of prayer requires thought, a clear head, and concentration. I don't think they were in that state at that time. Okay? I want to hear what you think of the answer.
All right.
I think that's the best answer, obviously, honestly speaking.
Okay.
Sometimes a person is too traumatized to be able to pray, and the fact that he recognizes that is to his credit.
All right. The point is that
the
text, as we look at the text, it would appear to me that they're in a state of rebellion and not in a state of trauma.
Well, and, they're in a state of rebellion until the snakes come.
Right.
Once they realize that there's a...
Produces trauma.
That produces trauma, and they're in a state of danger, and that's precisely the point. Now, who are they going to turn to in the state? So suddenly they realize what the reality is, that all along we'd had a tremendous protector over here. That was Moses, and they plead with Moses, and apologetically. And that's why Moses accepts, their entreaty, and he agrees to pray for them. Okay? Okay. Now, let's see if we can elucidate the various issues. As I mentioned, I'd like to understand what the nature of the sin was over here. What brought out this rebelliousness? Also, as I said, there were two elements over here. One complaint was that they said that, why did you take us out of Egypt to die in the wilderness? That was a very serious thing, a very serious distortion of what Moses and God had done for them. And the second thing, though, they said that their souls are weary with this light bread. Now, I just want to point out what Rashi says. it's based upon the Hebrew. The Hebrew is kolokel, which means kal means light, but it also means destructive. And Rashi adds this explanation from the rabbis, that this is what they said, that this is a destructive bread, because the manna was completely absorbed in their organs. Therefore, they referred to it as something destructive. And they said that this manna is destined to explode within us. We're going to explode. It's going to explode in our intestines. Did you ever hear of someone who's born of a woman that brings in food and doesn't excrete? In other words, according to the rabbis, the manna was a food which was the most perfect food. It was designed by God, and every element of it was utilized by the body, and therefore there was no need for excretion. Now, that was really a great good. That was something which was for their benefit. However, they took that and they distorted that. They made that into a negative. So there was, it wasn't just that they were tired of this food, but that there was an implied criticism in this food. And I think that's very significant. Now, what was the punishment? The punishment was the fiery snakes, the poisonous snakes, which came and bit the people. And I asked before, why did God choose to hit them in just this particular way? Now, again, I want to quote to you from Rashi, who's quoting from the rabbis. And Rashi says like this, on the verse which says, and they came and bit the people. So Rashi says, let the snake, which was smitten because of evil speech, let it come and avenge those who brought forth evil speech. That's one reason. He gives two reasons for the choice of the snake. And secondly, let the snake, for which everything tastes the same, let it come and take punishment, take revenge from those who denied the good. Because one thing, which is the manna, which was able to turn into many different tastes, they denied the good of that food. So there's really, Rashi is saying that the purpose of the snake is for two reasons. One is because it signifies the fact that they engage in bad speech, and the snake is symbolic of one who was punished for bad speech. And the second one's a little bit strange, because it seems that the snake can't distinguish between tastes. Everything tastes the same to the snake. So there's an additional element over here that they complained about, the manna. Now, according to the rabbis, the manna had the capacity to taste like any food, just about any food that you wanted. It was so perfectly designed. And still in all, it didn't satisfy them. So for these reasons, it has to be the snake which comes and takes revenge against them. Now, I'd like to elucidate that on a deeper level. I mean, it seems to be, the way it's stated, it seems a little bit too superficial. So they spoke badly, so they're punished by a snake, and a snake was also punished because it spoke badly. I mean, it seems like there's got to be some kind of a deeper notion over there. What's the comparison between a snake speaking badly and people speaking badly? It's two completely different worlds. And if we just leave it on that level, I think we're lacking something. So, aside from the fact that the idea of a snake is very significant to this whole story, the snake is a very significant element over here, especially when we're going to try and understand this idea of the sculpted snake. So what I'd like to do right now is to try and explain the symbolic significance of the snake. Now, I think that the choice, we're trying to understand the choice of the snake. I think it was chosen because it has a symbolical significance. Symbolical in the sense that it symbolizes certain very, very important concepts. And these concepts were very important to them in terms of what they had done wrong over here. Now, in order to explain this, I want to go back to the story in Genesis. The story of the snake itself. Of course, if we read that, again, it seems difficult to understand, if we take it literally, that Eve, Chava, sinned as a result of the seduction of the snake. It seems it's very difficult, because it would seem that if you take it literally, it's extremely difficult. That was there a snake which had intelligence? it seems that the only being that really had intelligence was a man and woman. It doesn't mention that a snake was created with intelligence, and that it was capable of seducing Eve, and that it was punished. The fact that if the snake was punished, it would imply that the snake also had free will. It's a very complicated area. And I would like to present to you the interpretation of the Sforno. The Sforno is one of the classic Bible commentators of the late Middle Ages. And he says that the discussion, the dialogue of the woman and the snake is not intended to be taken literally. He says that the snake is really a representation of, in Hebrew it's called the Yetzer Hara, the evil inclination. And what is the evil inclination? That's something that we should try to understand. What's the evil inclination in man, according to Judaism? Because how can there be an evil inclination? I mean, everything that exists is created by God, every part of man. Basically, the evil inclination is a reference to the instinctual part of man. And I want you to understand that there's nothing evil about the instinctual. As far as Judaism is concerned, there's nothing inherently wrong with the instincts, and a person is obligated to gratify his instincts, but the only reason why it's referred to as evil is because of the tendency that it has to thwart man from his purpose. In other words, there's nothing evil about any of the appetitive, the sexual instinct, the desire for food, and so on and so forth. None of the instincts are evil in their own right, but they're referred to as the evil inclination because they do have the capacity to entice man, to get him involved in a world of false values which are based upon the instincts and the emotions that go with them. That's why they're referred to as the evil inclination. So according to the Sforno, there was no discussion between Eve and a external snake, but really there's an internal dialogue going on between her rational faculty and between her emotional desire to partake of the fruit that was forbidden to her. And the Torah chooses to depict this inner dialogue as though it were an external dialogue between two separate entities, between two separate individuals. Now, the question arises, if the snake is nothing more than an illustration of the evil inclination, so why did the Torah choose to depict the evil inclination in the form of a snake, as opposed to any other animal? And the Sforno gives a very fascinating interpretation. And he says, it's because... Does anybody care to jump in at this point? Why would you think? Let me ask you a question. You're asking me so many questions. Let me ask the group a question. Why would you say that the evil inclination is being depicted as a snake? Why not a donkey, a horse, a dog, a bunny, anything?
Okay, well, why? Has anybody got a response? Jim, you always got a good answer.
I was listening to all those where it was the snake tried to seduce Eve.
One guy said he'd already read all those where the snake tried to seduce Eve. So
the snake tried to seduce, but I'm saying that it's not. What I'm saying is that it's really her own emotions that are seducing her.
Right.
What you really have to watch out for is your own emotions.
What I would say, approaching it from this side, that Eve is aware of the Yetzer Hara and the Yetzer HaTov, the good inclination and the evil inclination, and she is not subjugating her emotions to the good inclination. She is allowing the evil inclination to rule. Therefore, she rebelled against God. And then if you follow the context on through with Adam, when he was naked, meaning that he is completely open, realizing both the good and evil inclinations within him, and he's aware of the fact that God's aware of it. And therefore he hides from God because he doesn't want God to know him in the totality.
Right. Right. But the question that we're asking is...
Why the serpent?
Why the serpent, yeah.
Yeah, and I would say why the serpent... is that the serpent is, as the text says, he's subtle.
Very good.
And the emotions are subtle, in a term that I've used for years. All right. So the context I would say would come. That's my understanding of it.
Yeah, I would just like to fill in the words of the Sforno, which is basically in line with what you're saying.
Okay. Good. All right.
He says that the snake does a tremendous amount of damage because of the fact that it's not visible. And when you apply this idea to the instinctual side of man, you'll see that the reason why the emotions are so dangerous and why they get us into so much trouble is because we don't see that it's really the emotions that are at work. Most of the time, when a person is after something on the emotional level, he's able to camouflage it. And he's able to find a rationalization, and beyond that, some type of an idealistic purpose. It's interesting to note that even some of the worst tyrants in history never regarded themselves as being evil. They regarded themselves as being idealists. But if you break down the nature of their idealism, you'll see it's rooted in certain very powerful instinctual gratifications. And that's the problem. That's why it's difficult for a person to see his own emotions. People are very, very insightful about seeing the Yetzer Hara, the evil inclination in others. It's very easy to point out that in somebody else. But then when the focus is on the person himself, all of a sudden he has 20 excuses. That's not what he's really after. And you see, even the truth of the matter is that even a lot of noble activities, even charities and so on and so forth, and even in the religious sphere, the people themselves are totally convinced that they're doing everything for purely noble purposes, but they don't see the hidden personal agenda behind it. So the reason why it causes so much damage is because of its tremendous capacity to be subtle, to camouflage itself behind other types of motives. That's the reason why the Yetzer Hara is depicted as a snake. Now let's take this back to our story over here. Now, how does it fit in? There were two sins over here, as Rashi explains to us. First of all, they spoke badly about God and about Moses. That's the sin of Lashon Hara, which is slander, to speak slanderously about another individual. Now, I want you to know that that's regarded as one of the most serious sins in all of Judaism, as Maimonides points out. Someone who's a slanderer, who speaks evil things about other people. A person like that, if it becomes habitual, so Maimonides says he does not have a share in the world to come. So the Jews over here were guilty of the sin of Lashon Hara, of evil talk. But there was another sin that went along with it, and that was negation of the good, that they had negated the good that God had done for them with regard to, they were deprecating, they were degrading the manna, which was really the most perfect type of food. And they were distorting that and making it into something which was terrible. Now, in order to understand more fully what's going on over here, I'd like to explain to you why evil talk, slander, is regarded as such a terrible sin in Judaism. What is so terrible about an individual who speaks Lashon Hara, who speaks a gossip, slander? Now, interestingly enough, you know that the spies, the story of the spies, they were sent to spy out the land, and they wound up causing panic in the people, and because of that the Jews couldn't enter the land and so forth. So that story is juxtaposed next to the story of Miriam, the story of Miriam and Aaron, and you know what their sin was. Miriam was smitten with leprosy, and her sin was that she spoke evil talk about her brother Moses. So she was guilty, according to the rabbis, of the sin of Lashon Hara, of evil talk. Even though she was an extremely righteous woman, and she was on the highest level of prophecy, except for Moses, she was on the second highest level of prophecy, the same level as Aaron. Nevertheless, she committed the sin of speaking badly about Moses. She criticized Moses for having separated from his wife. She didn't realize, she didn't know that Moses had done so at the command of God. Now, the story of the spies comes immediately after the story of the sin of Miriam. And the rabbis posed the question, because every juxtaposition in the Bible is done for a reason, has a reason. So the rabbis say that what is the reason for the juxtaposition? Because she was punished for the sin of evil talk. And these individuals, that is the spies, they saw that she was punished, and they didn't learn a lesson from that, and they went ahead and they committed the same crime. Now the question is, where do you see that the spies were guilty of the sin of evil talk? Their sin was that they instilled fear in the people, but where is the evil talk? So the answer is because they spoke badly about the land of Israel. They came back with the report about the land, and they said it's a land which consumes its inhabitants. So that's considered to be slander. They slandered the land. Now, when I learned that Rashi, I was bothered by a question. Because I understand why evil talk is bad, because you're speaking about another human being, and you're causing a certain harm to that person. Every person is going to be harmed if people speak badly about him. If he hears about it, certainly he'll be harmed, because he feels bad. You're hurting his feelings. Even if he doesn't hear about it, but you're hurting his reputation. So his standing, his situation, he's going to be harmed in a certain way. So I can understand the concept of evil talk as it applies to speaking about another human being. But they weren't speaking about a human being. They were speaking about a land. Now, a land doesn't suffer. A land has no feelings. So it seemed to me very strange. How could you consider having the category of evil talk with regard to something like a land, which is inanimate? So the explanation that I'd like to present is as follows. It is true that evil talk is bad because of the harm that it's causing the person you're speaking about. But that's not the ultimate defect of the sin of evil talk. The real defect is the harm that you're causing yourself. You're destroying your own soul. Because what is the essence of evil talk? According to the Talmud, even if the things you are saying about another person are true, you're still guilty of evil talk. Because in all of evil talk, there's a distortion of reality. You're distorting the character of the other person. And that's why when you don't like an individual, so you're trying to paint a certain picture. So you're going to slant it. Now, of course, you may pick out if you're factual. You may pick out your facts pretty accurately. But the underlying objective is to distort the nature, to slander the person by giving him a certain slant. Now, the same is true, if that is the case, that the real crime is to distort something in objective reality, so it doesn't really make any difference whether it's a person or whether it's an object. So you can have the same defect even with regard to a land. Now, what causes a person to do that? What causes a person to slander something in the objective situation? It's always because he has a certain inner emotion which he himself can't face up to. And the rabbis say that whoever defames somebody, usually that defamation stems from his own weakness. You see a person going around and constantly accusing other people in general of cheating or this or that, always look into their character. It's quite possible that they partake of that defect. And that's why they're accusing others of it, because they can't face up to it within themselves. So this is perfectly illustrated in the story of the spies. What was their crime? They went to the land and they were overcome by fear. They saw these tremendous giants. And they were afraid. They thought they'd be wiped out. Now, the emotion of fear itself is not such a terrible thing. That's an emotion. That's not a crime to be fearful. But what should they have done? They should have come back and said that we were overcome by an emotion. They should have faced up to their emotion. They couldn't face up to their emotion. So rather than recognize that they had a certain weakness, they said, no. The weakness is not within us. There's something wrong with that land. They projected an inner weakness onto the situation, and they distorted the situation. That's the essence of Lashon Hara, of evil talk. And I believe that this is what occurred over here with the Jews, because the situation itself was really not a bad situation. In fact, it was a great situation. They didn't have to work to obtain their necessities. God had said, as the rabbi said, God had set up a table for them in the wilderness. They had everything that they needed. The manna was the most perfect food, but it was the most perfect food provided that an individual was living with the proper philosophy. It was designed by God to satisfy his basic necessities, but it wasn't designed by God to cater to all the emotions of lust. If a person was living properly and he related to food as a means to an end, to give him the strength that he needed, in order that he could be involved in the true good, which was to be involved in appreciating the wisdom of God as it's expressed in Torah and expressed in nature to elevate his soul, then he would have loved the manna. The manna would have been the most perfect food. And in fact, God wanted to make it easier to remove the burden of having to be involved in excretion and so forth. This food was the most perfect food. But no, they could not live up to that level at which they could appreciate the manna. They were on a lower level, and they were overcome by their weakness and by their desire to satisfy their instincts for food and lust and so on and so forth. So that itself wouldn't have been so terrible. But they could not admit the truth. They could not admit that they had a certain weakness. So rather than face up to the weakness within themselves and come to Moses and tell him we have a problem, we're not satisfied over here, but we realize that the problem is within us. Now, they blamed it on the situation, and that caused a total distortion of reality. And therefore that's the idea of let the snake come. Because the snake represents that tendency in man to act in accordance with his emotions without facing up to his emotions. And it expressed itself with regard to their negation of the manna, and it went even further than that. That wasn't the worst thing of all, but the worst thing of all was that it caused a complete distortion in their perception of Moses and of God. And Moses was the greatest benefactor, and God had done nothing but good for them, and yet they were able to say that God took us out of the land of Egypt in order for us to die in the wilderness. So therefore they were in a complete state of distortion. Now I'd like to try and elucidate, what is the concept over here? Okay, so the Jews were now completely broken down. They were broken down, and the way I explained it before, they were in a state where they realized they could not even approach God at this point, and so they asked Moses to intercede for them, to pray for them. And Moses prayed for them. And God said that he should construct an image of a snake. So Rashi says that he constructed it out of copper, a copper snake. What's the significance of that? What is the point of that? Why do they have to look at the snake? Now let me read to you another Rashi. And it's based upon a close reading of the verses over here, of the text. Because in verse 8, it says, God tells Moshe to construct a snake, and it says over there, it'll be all who are bitten, and they'll see it and live. So it just says all who are bitten. Then in the next verse, in verse 9, it says that Moses made the snake, and he placed it on a pole. And it was, if a snake bit the person, and he gazed intently at the graven snake, then he would live. So you notice that in the first verse, it doesn't mention specifically someone who was bitten by a snake. It says all who were bitten, implying that there were people that were bitten not just by snakes, but by other animals. And there it says if he just looked at it, he would live. However, in verse 9, it mentions those who were bitten by a snake. Now let me explain to you what Rashi says over here. Rashi says on the verse, all who were bitten. So Rashi says, even if the person was bitten by a dog or by a donkey, so then he would be wounded, and he wouldn't die immediately. His condition would worsen, would steadily worsen, but he wouldn't die immediately. But those who were bitten by snakes, they would die very, very quickly. So you see that there were two different groups. There were those who were bitten by other animals, by dogs or by donkeys, and that apparently wasn't that bad. Therefore, it says over here that they would look at it. A simple looking. They didn't have to stare so intently. In other words, the first group, the group that was bitten by dogs or by donkeys, so they didn't die that quickly. And their cure just demanded that they look at it. They didn't have to look that intently. They would gaze at it, and they would live. But then it says that with regard to the biting of the snake, it says the expression is, to gaze intently. And therefore, if a person was bitten by a snake, then the person would not be cured if he just glanced at it casually, but he'd have to concentrate with tremendous intention, with tremendous involvement. Okay? Okay. Then he proceeds and he says like this. He asks the question that we've been asking. And can a snake kill or bring to life? Does a snake have this power? And he's quoting from the rabbis. But he says, when the Jews would look upwards towards heaven and subordinate their heart to their Father in heaven, then they'd become cured. But if not, they'd be destroyed. So Rashi asks that question, finally. What power does a snake have to heal or to destroy? And his answer is that no, it's not the snake. But when the Jews looked upward to heaven and they subordinate themselves to God, so then they would be cured. And if they failed to do so, they'd be destroyed. That's his answer. But I think that that doesn't answer the question. Because if the cure now rested on the subordination of the heart, so what was the purpose of the snake? He has not explained to us the purpose of the snake. So, what I'm going to try and do is to elucidate the role of the snake.
Rabbi.
Yeah.
All right, two questions.
Sure.
And we got about 15 minutes to answer it.
All right.
Number one is one for myself. I look into the text of Torah and Tanakh, and I'm always aware of the presence of the Ben Noach there.
Yeah.
It would be my opinion that when he said that everyone and any man, and that man is Adam, any Adam, that the Ben Noach is there in the wilderness with Israel, with the B'nai Israel. So I think that could include them, that they had been bitten by the same serpent. That's the reason he just didn't say, allude to the fact of the descendants of Jacob or whatever.
Okay.
He uses the term Adam.
Okay, but bear in mind on that point,
okay,
because throughout this text it's mentioning the nation. It says the nation came. So according to what you're saying, your point would be that the Ben Noach is part of the nation.
All right, he is the Ger Toshav.
Right.
And if you say the nation, could that is just the what word is that in the Hebrew?
Am.
And so it's just nation.
Right.
And Israel is coming out a nation, and the nation is made up of the different classifications of people. The three breakdowns of Israel, plus the widow, the fatherless, the Ger Toshav, and the Ben Noach.
Well, in other words, the Ger Toshav would be the Ben Noach, who wants
yes.
to live together with the Jews.
Exactly.
I don't see any problem with that.
Okay.
Sure.
All right. The second statement would be, given the strong prohibition against idolatry, if this snake or this serpent is set there as a semblance of God or a type of redeemer, God is the redeemer, and here the snake is the healer and the redeemer, does this not cross the lines into idolatry?
Yeah, well, that's exactly my question.
Yeah.
You're restating the question that I tried.
Right.
That's precisely what is so problematic about this. About this story, and I'm going to try and elucidate it. The explanation I'd like to give is based upon how I explained the nature of the sin of evil talk and the whole role of the snake. The real, as we said, the real destruction of Adam, of man, whether it be Jew or Noahite, it makes no difference, is when the instincts completely overpower the individual and distorts his whole concept for understanding what's right and what's wrong. Now, the problem with the instincts is that they are hidden from a person. A person does not see the instincts. And what happened over here was that they were in a complete state of distortion and denial. Because, as we said, it's one thing to have problems, to desire a different kind of food, to desire a different situation. But once they began to blame the manna, which was the most perfect food, and once they began to blame Moses and God, then you see that they were in a complete state where they couldn't recognize their emotions. That's why prayer wasn't enough. It's true that Moses prayed for them, but that wasn't sufficient, because the only reason they were repenting now was because of the pain of the snakes. But that's just a temporary thing. Once God would remove the pain, if they did not address the underlying core, the underlying problem, then they'd go back to the same type of sinning. So God demanded something different. God demanded, in order for them to be cured, they had to reverse the process of inner corruption. And the process of inner corruption was that the emotions had become completely bound together with their reason. It had completely distorted their reasoning power. Now, there were two different groups over there, interestingly enough. There was one group that was bitten by the dog or the donkey. That apparently wasn't that serious. And there was another group that was bitten by the snake, and that was more serious. But we have to try and translate those two groups into categories that we can deal with, that we can recognize. I would say as follows, that there are two different types of corruption. There's one, all corruption stems from the fact that a person becomes dominated by an emotion. An emotion overpowers the mind. And insofar as the emotion overpowers the mind, so the person can't think straight, and he's involved in falsehood. And that's sin. That's the essence of sin. See, this can happen to anyone, though. This can happen to a person, to a mechanism that's basically healthy. Even a healthy person can fall into the pit of sin. Now, and insofar as he's involved in sin, he can't see the emotion. He's in a state of denial. But there's a difference. Because as long as the thinking mechanism of the person is not destroyed, it's not corrupt, then you can still deal with that person. You can still save that person. Because you appeal to his rational faculty, and you point out to him that in this particular area, he's being affected by his emotion. So until somebody points it out to him, he's not going to see it for himself. But once somebody points it out to him, since he's a rational person, he'll apply that rationality to the area, and he can be cured. A case in point in the Tanakh would be, for example, the case of David. David is one of the greatest men in all of history, yet he too sinned. In the case of Bathsheba, in the case of we sent Uriah to the front and he took Bathsheba, it was a terrible, terrible sin. Even though the rabbis point out that he didn't violate the halacha, but morally speaking, it was a terrible sin. But nevertheless, God sent Nathan the prophet, and he made that analogy, he made up that story in which he indicated what exactly he had done. If you're familiar with that story about the wealthy man who had many sheep, and he didn't want to, and he had a guest, didn't want to use his own sheep, and instead he took the sheep of a poor person who only had one sheep, and so on and so forth. And David said, that's a terrible, terrible thing. This person should be killed. Who is this person? And Nathan said, that person is you. And it struck David. And in one instant, David realized how it applied to his life. And he immediately did tshuva. He repented. So that, I believe, is the individual who was bitten. The individual who was bitten by the dog, it means to say that he too, the idea of biting means that you, God is demonstrating in a dramatic way that you've been affected by your emotions, by the animal part of you. So the person who was basically, his reasoning faculty was intact, but just that he'd been overcome in a certain area, so he wouldn't die so quickly, and for him, he just looked at the snake. The idea of looking at the snake is you've got to face up to your own snake. You've got to face up to your own particular emotion. That was the repentance that God demanded.
Rabbi?
Yes.
We don't have much time, and I wanted to get this question in because I think it's pertinent. In all this that you're speaking of, you're speaking of the repentance.
Yeah.
Basically, today, what is repentance as far as, I mean, you know, the short version, I guess. What exactly would you say repentance would be once you learned of your sin?
Yeah.
And he said you got 3 minutes.
Okay, fine. Repentance actually involves three steps in repentance. First, the first one is probably the most difficult. That's recognition of the sin. And it fits in with what we're saying because that's the hardest part, for a person to recognize that he's been deceived by his emotions. Because the ego always resists that. The first step is recognition. Then the second part is considered to be remorse. He must have regret and remorse because he realizes that insofar as he was overcome by his emotions, this has distorted his whole relationship with God. If he doesn't have that element, that the tragedy of being overcome by one's emotions is that it deprives him of the ultimate good. He can't have a proper relationship with God insofar as he's overcome by the instinctual. So he has to have remorse. He regrets the fact that this distorted his relationship with God. That's the second phase. The third part is what's called acceptance for the future. That is to say, he accepts upon himself that he's going to separate himself from this behavior and that he'll never do it again. So those are the three elements: recognition, remorse, and acceptance for the future. Which means to say that the individual has now separated himself, he's recognized. Now, to tie it in with this, if I can finish the point, the idea of looking at the snake is, and that's why Rashi says, when they subordinated their hearts to their Father in heaven, because insofar as they were blinded by an emotion, they couldn't subordinate their hearts to their Father in heaven because they were completely overcome by an emotion which was hidden. Now, the category of people who were bitten by the snake, that represents a much more serious spiritual illness. That's the type of person where the disease of the emotions is permeating his entire way of thinking. He can't think straight anymore. That's a much more serious case. You find that today. Individuals, you find it perhaps even lawyers, or you find it on college campuses. You find it among people, for example, who are sinning. And then, let's say a person, you find even religious leaders today that claim that it's okay, homosexuality is okay. So then people say, but what about the Bible? The Bible states openly that it's prohibited. And then, so, it's one thing for a person to say, okay, the Bible prohibits it, but I can't do anything about it. I can't control it. That's a level. But then there are people that will take these texts and totally distort the text. They totally distort the meaning of what the Torah is saying. That means to say that their entire method of thinking is corrupt. That's a much more serious kind of a thing. Because what are you going to win them back with? As long as a person can think clearly, he could be blinded in one particular area. Now, the case of the person who was bitten by the snake means that he was philosophically more corrupt because the emotions had reached a point where it was affecting his entire way of thinking. He couldn't think rationally. So that person had to stare and gaze intently until he was able to separate the emotions, not just from one particular area, but to reestablish his whole methodology of thinking clearly. And if he could not do so, then he would die. So I want you to understand one thing, that there was no magical or mystical significance to the copper snake. There was a philosophical idea behind it. And the rabbis in the Talmud state, they make the same statement with regard to the hands of Moses, that when the hands of Moses were lifted, the Jews were victorious over the Amalekites. And they say, do the hands of Moses conduct war? They say, no. But as long as the Jews subordinated their heart to their Father in heaven, then the Jews were victorious. So the hands of, at that point in time, they needed the whole image of Moses, and his perfection was essential for the Jews to relate them to the true idea of God. And the idea of the copper snake over here is that there's no mystical powers, but it's only because as a result of the snake, the Jews went through a very intense process of tshuva. By recognizing the snake within them and doing tshuva, that's what brought about the cure. But there's nothing mystical or magical in the snake itself. The truth is, as we read later on in the Book of Kings, that it was destroyed. The copper snake was preserved for generations, and Chizkiyahu, the king, destroyed it in his time because, as you pointed out very aptly, there were individuals on a low level who began to relate like an idol.
Rabbi, we're out of time, and you were breathing hard. What we'd like for you to do is come back next week because we've got a bunch of questions to ask you.
Okay.
And we'll clear it with the Rebbe.
You'll clear with Rebbe?
Yeah, we'll clear it with the Rebbe.
I need Rebbe's permission.
Right. And he'll be excited. And we'd like you to come back next week, and we have some questions we'd like to bring out in relation to this, okay?
Okay, fine. Thank you for the latest copy of the GAP.